University of California Television presents this podcast of At Canaan's Edge, America in the King Years, 1965 to 68, featuring the Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer of Martin Luther King Jr., Taylor Branch. This talk was recorded at the UC Santa Barbara campus in February 2006 and is presented by the Walter H. Capps Center at UCSB. For more information about this and other UCTV programs, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Enjoy the presentation.
It's indeed a pleasure to bring to the Capps Center and to Santa Barbara Taylor Branch. Taylor Branch concludes his magnificent history of the Civil Rights Movement and Martin Luther King's heroic role at the center of that movement in this latest of three books entitled At Canaan's Edge, America in the King Years, 1965-1968. As Branch's dramatic account demonstrates, King attained a stature akin to that of Lincoln, a commanding, prophetic figure who changed the legal and political structure of the nation while leading a victorious struggle for African American rights, and who lifted the patriotic spirit of the entire United States toward our defining of our national purpose in terms of freedom and equality. Taylor Branch is the premier chronicler of the civil rights era in America. The first volume of his epic trilogy was called Parting the Waters, America in the King Years, 1954-1963. It was published in 1988, for which he received the Pulitzer Prize for History and the National Book Critics Circle Award for Nonfiction. The second volume, Pillar of Fire, America in the King Years, 1963-1965, appeared in 1998 and won both the Sidney Hillman Book Award and the Isthmus Book Award. Both volumes were national bestsellers and helped earn Branch the National Humanities Medal in 1999. Please join me in welcoming Taylor Branch.
Thank you very much. I'm honored to be here in Santa Barbara and to be affiliated and sponsored by a new organization like this, dedicated to promoting interaction between the community of citizens and the community of scholars. I think we need a lot more of it, and I hope you'll feel the same way and why I feel that by the end of my remarks. This era is a vast era that goes all the way from Rosa Parks and the Montgomery bus boycott through the Vietnam War, the Black Panthers, the Black Power era, Chicago, Selma, the Voting Rights Act, an enormous transformation of America. Malcolm X, a lot of iconic figures. The chances that I would discuss the subjects that interest you in this panoply of thousands are pretty small, so I'm going to talk a little bit about what seems to bug or attract curiosity, which is why a white Southerner from Atlanta spent 24 years chronicling the civil rights era and why the book has taken this form, which grows out of that, and then take your questions on the subject, on the substance of what it is, and follow your interest. It wasn't a natural subject for me. My father, I was born in Atlanta in Dr. King's city, but never even laid eyes on him during his lifetime. I was raised in a resolutely anti-political family, not a non-political family. There's a distinction. My father's maxim growing up was that people interested in politics could not find honest work. And we imbibed that. He believed hard work was the cure for everything. He was from South Georgia. My mother was from Birmingham. She was, as he put it, a UN liberal in the South. Always believed that things should be better, and we were trained to be polite, but to stay out of politics. My dad had a dry cleaning plant and six children, trying to survive in the dry cleaning business. I started working there from the age of about four or five. My first job was putting the little trouser guards on hangers by the box of 500, and I wasn't very good at it, and I was shuttled around various other jobs in a dry cleaning plant by Dad's employees, nearly all of whom were black. They called me baby and sugar and considered me a pain in the butt, by and large. But I was the boss's son. We didn't talk about race very much at all growing up. This is in the early 1950s. But I was growing up in the segregated South, and we only knew from really subliminal signals that there was a lot of cultural danger around us. My dad's cleaner, the guy who was the heart of the dry cleaning business, was a guy named Peter Mitchell, who would arrive at work every morning, and I would go to work too, 6:30, 7 o'clock in the morning. Peter would come in a three-piece suit and $100 shoes, which was a lot back in the 50s, looking like he was going to visit the Queen of England. Only years later, after he died, did my dad tell me that Peter once told him that was the only way he thought it was safe to get across Atlanta as a black man to come to work, that he had to dress so impeccably that he didn't make himself vulnerable. When he got to work, he changed clothes out of this splendid traveling attire into the grungiest outfit I ever saw, with an apron, always had a cool cigarette smoking, because he put the clothes in and out of the dry cleaning wheel with these fumes, if any of you know about dry cleaning, that killed him and my father years later because they're carcinogenic. But he'd be in the middle of this, surrounded by steam presses, and it'd be 110, 120 degrees. It was a grungy job, but by the time he changed from his street clothes into his work clothes, usually Peter and my dad would have already played two or three practical jokes on one another and exchanged jokes. They were two of a very unique breed in my experience, people who can remember every joke they ever heard and deliver them well. And they had a running banter going on almost every subject under man and under the sun, and lots of practical jokes. One of their running bits of banter was over professional baseball. They had a daily bet on the outcome of professional baseball in Atlanta. We had a minor league team, believe it or not, named the Atlanta Crackers. And every day, my dad bet 25 cents, naturally, for the Crackers, and Peter, the black man, bet against the Crackers. And they would always talk about these games, among many other subjects. And on two or three occasions, they took me to the games when I was 6, 7, 8 years old. And I remember this because it occasioned one of the few comments that I ever heard my dad make about race. Going to the games, we would be full of this banter, and they would be joking and laughing. But as we got near the ballpark, the laughter would die down, and the conversation would get glum. And eventually, they'd have to figure out how they were going to meet after the game, because Peter had to go sit in the colored section. And then we had to figure out how to get back together. And once or twice, walking to the game with my dad after Peter had separated, he said the same sentence to me twice. And all he said was, "I don't like this." And I don't know what he meant. I don't think that it was political. I think what he really meant was that he didn't like being deprived of the continuing banter, because that's what he did all the time. But I do know that even as a very small boy, I knew, without being told, that there were to be no follow-up questions, like, "What do you mean, Dad?" or any of that, that he was communicating to me something very significant, that this was a dangerous subject, that you didn't ask a lot of questions about it. And that was kind of the nature of race in the pre-Martin Luther King South,
It was like the weather. It was dangerous. You didn't talk about it very much. And there was a kind of an intimate alien relationship between the races, or could be, across these lines, like between my dad and Peter. Peter died in about 1958 when I was 11. I went to the funeral with my dad. We were the only two white people in the church. And it was definitely the first time I ever saw people, what was known as falling out in a church service, which meant essentially that some of the mourners would seem to have a heart attack and jump up and shout and scream and cry, and then they would keel over. And people would come running down the aisles dressed in what I thought were nurses' uniforms and carry them out. And this was an amazing phenomenon to me. And I was stunned. And then the minister stood up and said, "I see that Mr. Branch is here, and we'd like to have him say a few words from the church." And I almost fell out. And my dad went up there and started talking about Peter. And in the middle of this, with continuing commotion out amongst us in the church, he broke down and started crying, telling stories about Peter, which was one of the first times I ever saw my own father cry in this funeral. So we absorbed in that era this notion that there was a strange communion across the lines of race, but a great deal of danger as well. Most people, and the civil rights movement by then was beginning like a storm to gather. But nobody thought that it was going to change anything any more than you could change the course of a storm. And we all kind of were frightened of it. The first thing I remember of wondering about all of this and starting to get in my mind because of the persistence of the civil rights movement came in about 1961, when I was 14. This is the year of the Freedom Rides. I didn't pay any attention to the sit-ins or the Freedom Rides, even though these are occurring in my formative years. But one day I was going to school and talking to somebody about how much I disliked rock and roll music because I'd been trained in the Atlanta Boy Choir. And I was somewhat condescending toward all pop music. And the guy who was driving me to school said, "How come if you don't like pop music, you are sitting here singing the words to every Sam Cooke song and every Jackie Wilson song on the radio?" And it was a stunning admission to me that I knew the words of all these pop music crossover songs. And furthermore, that some of the people I knew who were most hostile to black people were the very ones who would sneak out and go down to the Herndon Stadium to hear Ray Charles, or go down to the Royal Peacock in Atlanta to hear Jackie Wilson and Wilson Pickett. So there were mysteries that I was thinking about race. But that's about all. I was planning to be a surgeon and play football and chase women, and that was about it. Until the summer of 63, I'm 16 years old, and I saw the photographs of dogs and fire hoses loosed on children in Birmingham who were half my age. I later found the photographs of them and made sure to put them in the book. They were as young as 6 and 8 years old, and they were mostly girls, and they weren't running from the dogs and the fire hoses. They were going right through them, singing songs very much like I sang in Sunday school. And to me, this was stupefying and arresting. And I didn't have a theory about it. I only had a question. And I think really nagging quests and maybe even a lot of social movements begin more with questions than with theories. I just said, where did this come from, this elementary power? Nobody gave me an answer. But it did, against my own will and against my father's maxims, and much to his consternation, change the whole direction of my life's interests. And when I got to college, I started losing interest in my pre-med classes. And finally, in a very grandiose and ceremonial manner, made a necklace of cherry bombs to blow up the baby tiger shark I was dissecting in a pre-med biology course. Dropped all of those courses, and became devoted to history and philosophy, trying to figure out where this movement had come from. By 1969, I'm out of college. I don't have any idea what I want to do. I felt that I had a desperate sense need to have at least some minor acquaintance with the civil rights movement because I knew it had changed my interests. By then, the Vietnam War was raging. Dr. King was dead. He died when I was a senior in college. He was killed. My mom was there at college because we were having a symposium on China. I still remember that, how much it meant to her. And I went, basically, I was at Princeton in graduate school, and I went to the people there and said, instead of doing what you want me to do in the summer between the master's year, two programs, which was to work for the Ford Foundation or the Bureau of the Budget or some, as they put it, policy-relevant work environment, I wangled a job from Vernon Jordan, who was head of the Voter Education Project in Atlanta. And it was a very special job. He said he had 20 counties. This is the same Vernon Jordan who was later President Clinton's friend. He said he had 20 counties in southwest Georgia where, after 15 years of the civil rights movement, they didn't even have any contacts. They didn't know anybody. There was nobody on the Rolodex. And they didn't have very much money. And the job he offered me was that if I was willing, he would pay me $10 a day if I would go in to these counties blind and try to find, take 3 days per county and try to find people willing and able to administer a voter registration grant. Because he said there were practically no black registered voters. I did this alone. I made a fool of myself more times than I can count. It was like stepping off the end of the universe. Columbus could not have been more lost when he sailed west than I was when I went into South Georgia. So I thought basically all I would do was go into these tiny little counties and look for Martin Luther King. Could find the next one, and I would discover him like Cecil B. DeMille. Preachers didn't work. They said they had things under control, even though you could feel the fear in these counties, which itself was a great revelation to me. Neither did school teachers, principals, funeral home directors, or any of the other things I tried. Switchblade rebels, that I tried some of them for a time and got myself arrested in Bubba Doo's Big Apple in Cuthbert, Georgia, which was a juke joint out in the country where I thought if I took their money in poker that I could get some of the tough guys involved, interested in voter registration. And the sheriff walked in. It's the dry county with the Miller Beer Man. The Miller Beer Man was delivering the beer, and the sheriff was taking his cut from Bubba Doo for not arresting him for getting beer. And there were many other illegal things going on in Bubba Doo's, but the one that interested him the most was me, and he arrested me on the formal charge of being on the wrong side of town. Took me to jail. I'm scared to death, but then he goes and brings over the mayor, who's also the druggist, who explained that Cuthbert was not a hick town and that he went to Atlanta every Sunday to get a haircut and go to the opera, and that he was very disturbed that the sheriff had found me there. And the sheriff gave him my wallet, out of which he fished my Princeton ID card, and the mayor blanched, and he said, "I went to Princeton. Sheriff, we're not going to have a Princeton man in our jail, even if he is a communist. Take him to the county line." So that was like county number 8. But halfway through the summer, I gave up on men altogether, had a whole new adventure, whole new theory of trying to do women. And the way I did women was to just go out in the new county's cornfields and look for people out in the fields and ask them if there were any matriarchs that might look favorably on a voter registration project. Most of the people were terrified too much to talk to me for fear of being seen. But finally, somebody suggested that there was an old, as they put it, Civil War people going all the way back to the Civil War, and that there was a matriarch in this one county called Schley County, Georgia, tiny little county. And so I got the directions and went to her place And it was the morning that Neil Armstrong landed on the moon, July 20th, I think it was, 1969. So I was halfway through my summer, and she was rocking on the porch, and I started talking to her about a voter registration in Sly County and how the figures show that there were no black registered voters, and that this was an important, and that there were people who would pay people to register voters down there if they could find them. She kept rocking, and I kept asking her questions, and she never answered a single one of them. And it seemed like an eternity, but I know it was 5 or 10 minutes. She didn't say anything. And finally, she said to me, "Do you really believe we landed on the moon this morning?" That was all her first statement. And I said, "Yes, ma'am, I do, because I saw it on Walter Cronkite back at the motel before I came over here." So I was talking about that and very much off balance because this lady hadn't said anything. And as usual, I found when I got nervous and was off balance, I started using large, big graduate school words about voter registration grants and a 501c3 tax-exempt organization and the flow-through and the structure for these grants, and that wasn't going over. And finally, her second question, I've been there, I don't know, 20 minutes, her second question was, "Have you seen the Simonized Wax commercial?" And I said, "You mean the one where the children float across the kitchen floor on an invisible shield of Simonized wax and they don't scuff the floor because they're on the invisible shield?" "Yes, ma'am, I've seen that." And she said, "Do you believe that?" So now I'm even more off balance because I think that this woman may not be crazy, that she may be a genius. So I'm saying, "Yeah, I believe they can make it look like the children are floating across the kitchen floor, but that's a trick and everything, but that's in an advertisement, and they do those things in advertisements. But I saw the moon landing on a news show, and in news shows they don't do that, because now I'm worried that she's playing with me here about the difference, and I'm trying to assure her that you can believe things on news shows, but that there are illusions on non-news shows, you know, and on commercials." And she didn't talk. She asked me about 4 more questions in the course of a long conversation that I won't bore you with, and it went on forever. She finally said that she could prove, young man, we didn't land on the moon, and I can prove it. She said, "If we landed on the moon, then all we'd have to do is fill up our tank on the moon once, and on the next jump, we could make it right into heaven. And you know God wouldn't let us do that, so we didn't land on the moon." By this time, I already knew that this was an amazing way that she had of telling me that she was not interested in a voter registration grant, but that she was teaching me things about what's real and what's fearful. And what's apparent, and that voting in her county, to her bone marrow, having lived 100 years, was a matter of life and death, and a matter of great fear, and the realities were not what you seemed, and that she wasn't of an age where she was going to risk her life and her loved ones' lives on the word of a 22-year-old graduate student talking about a 501c3 organization. Now, by the end of the summer, I did recommend 3 counties for voter registration grants to the incoming head of this same organization. Vernon Jordan left, and John Lewis, who's now the congressman from Atlanta, came in, and I recommended 3 counties, all headed by women, all from the same profession that I never would have dreamed in a million years before I started. They were all midwives. And in fact, by the end of the summer, I was only looking for midwives because I had seen the natural authority and independence they had. They weren't dependent on the white people in the school board or anywhere else. They didn't put on airs. They knew everybody, and they had a way of dealing with fear in life and death situations at birth. And I watched more than one of them tell people who were terrified to meet even me, which was a remarkable thing, to talk about voting, "Yes, you are coming to that meeting, because I birthed you and everybody in your family, and I have things to tell if you don't come to this meeting." And they would make them come. And they were really good. And they, several of these ladies two of the three women became county commissioners and were quite successful in voter registration. But I had experiences like Bubba Doo's and the lady in the rocking chair. My first reaction to that was to go home every night back to the motel and write down every word they said. It was the first thing I ever wrote that wasn't assigned by a teacher. It grew into a diary of 400 pages by the end of that summer of 69. And I turned it in to Princeton, where I had been assigned grudgingly to write a policy memorandum on the implications, economic implications of what I saw down there. And I turned the diary in instead and said, the language of policy doesn't reach the reality that I experienced down there. Here's this diary. And of course, that caused a big academic crisis. And but one of the professors on my very unhappy three-man master's team sent this whole diary off to a magazine that began publishing excerpts of it. The first thing I ever had published was something I didn't submit for publication, something I wrote only because I knew of no other way to handle the reality of being so much out of my element in this summer of experiencing the civil rights movement. Out of that grew, though, my belief that in race relations or any place where we're divided by cultural barriers, we make our biggest discovery by leaping through those barriers, but not on the basis of our abstract connections and labels, but on the basis of having things become so human that they dissolve your labels, and that you forget the labels and the categories that we are taught to reason with, and you make discoveries by human leaps and bounds. And by the time in 1982, when I finally had enough experience as a writer to ask to do what I wanted to do, answer the question, where did this movement come from? Where did those little girls came from that were marching in Birmingham? I only had one rule, which is that I wanted it to be storytelling and to make every effort I could to get it into the heart of every character, at least enough to let people have a sense of what they were like as human beings on all sides of this great human freedom struggle. The White House, the FBI, sharecroppers trying to decide whether to register to vote, whether to risk their lives or not. Bob Moses, Martin Luther King, all the people by then that I had grown to admire. I had by that time, another musical analogy, much like my Sam Cooke awakening when I was a teenager. I decided that our Vietnam generation of college students had oversimplified, with dangerous historical consequences, the depth and the passion inside the civil rights movement. We tended to be condescending toward it. We thought the civil rights movement was kind of turn the other cheek, got carried away over simple matters, and that was good enough for segregation. But we are now dealing with the Vietnam War, and so these are big, we needed to take this over. And even then, as a student, I felt that there was something wrong with that, that the movement was as deep as it was powerful, and that we were patronizing it, and that in some senses the Vietnam anti-war movement of predominantly white students on campus covered the civil rights movement the same way Pat Boone used to cover Little Richard songs, that we would put out a simplified and highly popular version of the saltier original about 6 months later. And we risked a great deal in doing that and oversimplifying it. The consequence of the rule to do storytelling makes the project, it was supposed to last 3 years, it lasted 24. It's supposed to be one book, it's now three, because it is storytelling. I count myself, I never told Christy I had any inkling that it would go this long because I didn't have it myself, and if I had, I wouldn't have told her. But it is the nature of storytelling, and I think that on a subject as deep as this, I'm still convinced that it's the best approach. What it is a story of hundreds of ordinary citizens who become heroes by taking democracy seriously, by taking their faith seriously, their civic faith, and their spiritual faith, and they struggle with it. and they find that democracy itself as a subject is every bit as broad as philosophy and as deep as religion, and that we do it no service, especially since our official civic faith is that it's an experiment, to take it for granted and to diminish it, and to have it so little studied in our fields of learning, let alone to have an atrophied kind of spitball political discourse pass for carrying on the work of democracy in the modern time. There are many, many amazing citizen heroes growing out of the civil rights movement. This book is dedicated to Diane Nash, who is a young Chicago Catholic girl who could pass for white, but by the time she was 24 years old, had done four or five times, confronted democracy and expanded the meaning of the word movement right up into history. The Freedom Rides were her ideas when they had the crisis of the Freedom Rides and the first adult Freedom Riders left when they were beaten at Birmingham on Mother's Day in 1961. Diane interrupted her Nashville picnic, where they were having a Mother's Day picnic to celebrate the end of segregation in the Nashville movie theaters after a 60-day campaign of jail going and violence against them. She said, "We have to suspend this picnic and go down and take up the Freedom Ride in Birmingham, because if the movement lets violence stop it anywhere, we will collapse everywhere." And of course, all of her friends said, "Well, can't we finish the picnic first? We have our own problems here." And she essentially nagged them till she ruined the picnic. Her husband, Jim Bevel, wildly improbable husband, he's the one that Dr. King said of him that he's a prophetic figure, and it's the cracked ones who let the light in. Bevel said that when Diane gets on you about a subject like, "We can't have this picnic because we have to go down there and risk our lives in the Freedom Ride," he said she got on you the way the leeches got on Humphrey Bogart in the river with Katharine Hepburn and the African Queen, and there's just no living with her until she provoked the Freedom Rides into becoming a national and international phenomenon by having kids go from Nashville the very next morning. She and Bevel also had the idea of using the small children in Birmingham that had such an enormous effect on me. And a few months after that, on the night of the Birmingham church bombing, when the four little girls were killed in the very church from which the children marched into the dogs and fire hoses, she and Bevel stayed up all night, breaking furniture, breaking windows, gnashing their teeth, feeling responsible for the death of the children because it had been their idea to use small children as amazing, unprecedented historical actors. And they vowed that by morning, together, that they would make a pact to answer this crime, either by vigilante justice, which was rising with the popularity of Malcolm X at that time, the idea of it anyway. And they made several calls to find people who everybody knew who the Klansmen were who set the bomb. The last one was only convicted last year, 42 years later. They knew who did it, and they also knew some people, some switchblade types, maybe Bubba Doo for all I knew, but somebody who would do something about it. But they decided that they knew more, and they'd had an amazing intellectual and spiritual political investment in nonviolence. And by 6 o'clock the next morning, they had a nonviolent plan to answer this, which they wrote up. It's a document. You can see it at the King Center now. It was a plan to create a nonviolent army and paralyze Alabama until it granted black people the right to vote there, on the theory that if black people had the right to vote, the state wouldn't slough off crimes like the Birmingham church bombing as easily as it did. She drove into Birmingham, into the crisis demonstrations. Dr. King was about to go up and see President Kennedy. There was a funeral. There was a threat of riots. People were milling about angrily in the street, pushed her way in and handed it to Martin Luther King and said, "We need to do this. When you have people willing to give their lives, you have to give them leadership." And he said, "Diane, we've just gotten the civil rights bill to end segregation before Congress after 10 years of agitation. I can't say, well, let's suspend that because Diane Nash wants to work on voting rights. We can't do that. But she nagged him like Humphrey Bogart, too. And she pestered him all through the next year. And when the Civil Rights Act of 1964 passed and he won the Nobel Prize, Diane more than offset Dr. King's staff that unanimously felt that entitled to dine out on the Nobel Prize and the end of segregation for about two decades of congratulatory chicken dinners. And instead he said, we're at the mountaintop, but the valley calls. And he went to Selma because her blueprint was the Selma right to vote movement. So here, this comes from a 24-year-old black woman who took it for granted that part of being a citizen in a democratic country, in part because she had been denied its benefits and saw it as an outsider, that the first thing you do is if you really believe that the direction of the country is equally up to you and to the president, that you should act like it and not petition or wait for somebody else or gripe or anything, but that it's up to her to address the Birmingham church bombing. And she did. She stunned me years later when I was talking to her about something, one of the many nasty things that J. Edgar Hoover did to the students, not just to Martin Luther King. There's one in the book here where Hoover had his agents call Stokely Carmichael's mother and say people were coming to kill him. These are agents, FBI agents, under cover of anonymity, just messing with them. And I was talking to Diane about it, and she says, oh, don't talk to me about Hoover. Hoover is our fault. I said, what do you mean? And she said, well, we left him in a position of arbitrary authority for 50 years, and we got exactly what anybody who reads the Federalist Papers or the Constitution would expect to get. The citizens did that. We let him stay there. And I'm a black person, but we're citizens too. And if we take our country seriously, we wouldn't let stuff like that happen. So we have citizens, heroes here. I still believe in this huge story that the great lessons, and I'm going to violate my principles that it comes out of storytelling. I don't put too many lessons in the book. That we learn by details, but that democracy is an enormous responsibility and that we really have a dumbed-down discussion of it. It's one of the best things about Martin Luther King, that he understood and had a sturdy message in the midst of a crucible of opposition. People wanting to kill him every day. His professed supporters, like the New York Times and the Washington Post, are condescending to him, telling him, don't talk about foreign policy, don't do this, don't do that. Always telling him he wasn't doing the right thing. And his own staff was pulling him in every direction possible. And what made him uniquely a spokesperson for a citizen's movement, following the movement often, and humbly saying that the movement and even these students were ahead of him tactically on what it took to bring democracy to the fore. But what he did have was an amazing sense of humor behind the scenes and an incredibly sturdy balance between civic faith and spiritual faith, what he called the notion, the balance between equal votes and equal souls. That's what makes America unique. That the idea, he believed, for equal votes as the intuition of freedom, which makes America a unique country, he believed was grounded in the preceding religious notion from the Hebrew prophets of equal souls before God. And that he put those almost in all of his rhetoric. One day the South will know that when these disinherited children of God sat in at lunch counters, they were in reality standing up for the best in the American dream and for the most sacred values in our Judeo-Christian heritage. So he put one foot in the Constitution and the Declaration and one foot in the Scriptures, one foot in Jefferson and Lincoln, and the other foot in Isaiah and Jeremiah and the Gospels. And he put both feet in nonviolence because he said that nonviolence was at the heart of our civic faith, and we don't think about it. Every vote is nothing but a piece of nonviolence. Every ballot is nothing but that. Democracy is structured anger management, and American political theory is the first political theory on earth that has changed from something that is vertical the kings and liege lords and the great chain of being into horizontal bonds of strength among citizens. And of course, at the same time, our civic faith, our spiritual faith, nonviolence, is at the heart of justice and at the heart of the Christian message of loving your enemies. And King, the great furnace in his voice would come when he said, religious people find it too easy to discard their central teachings and accept the premise that we're against all wars except the one we're in. And in that sense, the centrality of King and his message of spirit and civics and unifying really is a great mystery. Needs to be studied much more. I'll just give you one tiny example that jumps out at me. He spoke about religion and politics in 4 or 5 speeches a day for his entire short career, 14 years, died when he was 39. Talked about religion and politics every day. He had many enemies. He was never a comfortable figure in America. He was inspirational, but he was also scary. He had many enemies and many critics and many patronizing intellects. But I can't find on the record that any critic ever attacked King for mixing church and state. This, to me, is a real miracle and betokens his genius for doing it at such an ecumenical level and such a non-threatening way of drawing on both patriotic and spiritual heritage in a way that would not offend anyone and allow everyone in for inspiration as they saw fit. Without doing what most people do when they mix church and state, which is to try to subdue one to the other. They either want to kick religion out of politics on a secular notion that religion has caused a lot of pain in the world, or they want to subdue all of politics to some dogmatic and schismatic notion of religion. King did neither. It's remarkable. And he never spoke about race either. Race exclusively is the grounding message. It was always democracy. It was always equal souls and equal votes. And he said that they were, the movement was to redeem the soul of America, to lift America toward its only story, freedom. And that when he did, when the movement did, its blessings would flow far beyond the end of terror, which dots the pages of this story not that long ago, and segregation in the South. That it would liberate white people, for one thing. It would liberate the white South, which was so imprisoned in the psychology of segregation that it wasn't even fit for professional sports teams. We had the Atlanta Crackers because we couldn't have major league sports until the end of segregation, when the mayor of Atlanta said we built a stadium with money we didn't have on land we didn't own for a team we hadn't found. But they got the Atlanta Braves almost instantly. And in Miami, they created the Miami Dolphins. And this is just a metaphor for the springing up of the Sun Belt. The end of segregation liberated the white South and destigmatized white politics, Southern politics. I'm not sure it's a good thing, but the leaders of both political parties have tended to come from the South, and they could never have done that when it was segregated. And the benefits flowed far beyond that. Klansmen murdered civil rights workers in Lowndes County, which is a sub-theme and a through story of this last volume. And they were acquitted, even though they did the murders in open daylight, by all white male juries. And Pauli Murray, another citizen hero, filed suit because in Alabama, under state law, no females were allowed to serve on juries in 1966. Petty juries, criminal juries, grand juries, civil juries, none. And it wasn't the only state. They weren't, the right of women to serve on juries was restricted in 30 states. The prevailing Supreme Court decision, Hoyt v. Florida at that time, upheld a Florida law that said if you were a female in the state of Florida and you wanted to serve on a jury, you had to go down to the courthouse at your own initiative and sign an affidavit attesting to your desire to be considered for a jury pool and to certify that you would not, it would not interfere with your homemaking duties. This country was stratified in ways that we conveniently forget and take for granted before the movement started struggling with what equal citizenship meant far beyond the race issue. And we take those benefits for granted. Pauli Murray, for example, had been excluded from my university, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, rejected in a letter that officially said, and I have a copy of it, we do not accept students of your race. She was a black woman. She was then rejected at Harvard Law School in a letter that said out front, we do not accept students of your sex. She persisted, became a lawyer anyway, filed this suit, White v. Crook, that overturned and eventually went all through the United States, overturning laws that restricted the right of women to serve on juries. At the same time that other decisions overturned laws that restricted the right of black and white people to marry. It was illegal to marry until 1967, Loving v. Virginia. Pauli Murray was involved in that too. Her university, the University of North Carolina, when I went, by state law, restricted all females. Couldn't be a female student at the state university unless you were a nursing student. We only got women on the weekends when I was there. People don't remember that. All of that changed. But then 10 years later, Pauli Murray also said, this had still carried over into the field of religion, and she became, in the great struggle, in the first group of female Episcopal priests in the history of the Anglican tradition. She was ordained in 1976 among the first group at the age of, she was nearly 70 when she did that. And there was a huge schism in the church with several of the bishops walking out saying that the Bible itself guaranteed authority to males. And there was huge struggle over that that's very much reminiscent of the struggle today over gay clergy, that the church is going to fall in if we allow this. The civil rights movement set in motion democratizing forces that are still washing up on our shores in our empirical reality. And at the same time, our language and our appreciation and our capacity to hope for future democratic miracles has atrophied. It's almost like the world is hitting us over the head. We built nuclear weapons for 40 years, expecting that the Soviet Union and the Cold War would only end in some sort of Armageddon. And instead, you have some nonviolent dock strikes, and you have people singing We Shall Overcome at the Berlin Wall, and in Prague and the Velvet Revolution, and they're hitting us on the head saying, your inspiration did this, but we don't feel it. The spirit of nonviolence is alive at the heart of democracy outside the United States more than here. And we don't take the civil rights movement as a model for how you should go about thinking about not only refining but inspiring the democratic example in a world that has no other major contending political system of organization. So the legacy of the civil rights movement is ahead of us. It's not what we remember about Martin Luther King in the past and the terrible tendency that we have now to try to pigeonhole it as something that was confined to a particular race in time and a spokesperson for a particular cause. He was, and the movement was, a modern founder in the sense doing exactly what Madison and Jefferson and Lincoln did. They confronted systems and daily lives of systematic hierarchy and subjugation and figured out nonviolent, permanent, inspirational citizenship ways to build equal citizenship. That is the redeeming purpose of why we're Americans and what we can truly offer the world. And to me, as a white Southerner who grew up in my dad's dry cleaning plant, the greatest miracle of all of these is that a people who had been excluded from democracy and its blessings and had seen mostly its boot heel and whiplash nevertheless had the political genius, the nonviolent discipline, and the indescribable grace to lift the rest of the country toward our own professed values. And that's what we need to remember every Martin Luther King Day, and that is what I hope you will find in all the hundreds of stories of Democratic heroes in this trilogy, America in the King Years. Thank you.
Yes, Dr. King made it clear that he was not afraid to die for a cause.
Right.
The question I have, is it a fair assumption to know that it was a matter of not if, but when he was going to die? Did he actually believe that?
Yes, he did. And it wasn't hard because he was getting threatened almost every day from the bus boycott on. And so, and it is true, of course, one flip side of that is that people think that he had a sudden premonition of death on the night before he was killed when he made the I've been to the mountaintop speech. The I have been to the mountaintop was new, but the premonition of death, and he had been preaching sermons like that pretty much for his whole career. What was new in the I've been to the mountaintop speech in Memphis the night before he was killed was not a sense of his own mortality. I mean, he had preached the drum major instinct just a couple of months before, where he did his whole funeral. He said, you know, told him what to say at the funeral. What was new in that one the night before, with tornadoes breaking and the heavens, it was such a weird, eerie evening, was that he said that he didn't think that the last movement he was in, the Poor People's Campaign, he didn't come right out and say it, but that it wasn't going to have a breakthrough. He was losing the command of the country, wasn't going to have a breakthrough in his lifetime the way Birmingham had and Selma had. Nonviolence was receding because the New York Review of Books was making fun of it, and Black Power, you know, across the board, it was fell to fatigue and to weary anger from Black people saying, I've been nonviolent for 6 years. Why does America admire nonviolence only in Black people? And otherwise, it admires John Wayne and James Bond. And there's no answer to that. And King didn't have an answer. That's not fair that the people who've been victimized for lack of rights should have to seek out further suffering. So nonviolence declined. And he said, you know, we're doing this to redeem the soul of America, but that's a pretty hard argument to sell to a 25-year-old kid who's been beaten half a dozen times. So it was declining, and it was the whole country was poisoned by the climate of war over Vietnam. And so what he said in that last speech was, you know, I may not get there with you, but we as a people will get to the promised land, almost like some generation in the future is going to pick up this cause, because the private reality within his movement was that his staff was not on board with the Poor People's Campaign. They were pulling in all different directions, and the impetus of nonviolence, which he more and more became lonely, saying this is the agent of change. This is what has really set these things in motion. But essentially what he was saying is, we as a people will get to the promised land when the cycle turns again. That's the way, if you study that that last speech. So the expectation of death runs throughout his career. The notion that he might be leaving a testament for the future, and that he might be killed before even a movement could take hold again, is new in that last speech, which is basically where I get my title. You know, at Canaan's Edge, I have seen the promised land. I've been to the mountaintop. I've looked over. You know, just like Moses, who was not allowed to go to the promised land because he screwed around too long in the wilderness. And built, you know, his people had built idols and that sort of thing. But he was allowed to look over from Jordan, across the Jordan River, but not allowed to go in. And the king, by analogy, got to Canaan's edge. And the country would, it's up to us to revive that and take the next step. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you for your books.
Thank you.
You said about your summer when you were working on the voter registration that the policies didn't match the realities, all the policy
the language.
Talk.
Yeah.
I wonder if you would say the same about such things as the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act and the way they played out, whether all that language didn't really meet the reality of the ramifications after those were passed?
Well, yes and no. I mean, you can't deny those two bills had an enormous effect. The Voting Rights Act changed the structure of partisan politics to this day. I mean, if you look back, there were precious few black voters in the South. There became 4 million new black voters in the South, which forced two-party competition in the South for the first time in 100 years. It had been an ossified one-party structure. Now, we're still evolving in that way, but you know that is a big change. Lyndon Johnson quite rightly said, signing this act is going to give away the South to a new Republican Party, which basically didn't even exist in the South. Any of you who grew up in the South like me remember, you know, Republicans were like polar bears. We just didn't have them. They didn't exist. They were Yankees until Barry Goldwater voted against the Civil Rights Act of 64. So these things do matter. I mean, politics and language and laws do matter, and the Civil Rights Act of 64 outlawed things like state laws in North Carolina that kept women out of the state university, and you know, legal segregation in not only in lunchrooms and lunch counters and in public life, but in employment. And to a degree that it's too easy to forget, we do take for granted an enormous amount of interaction in the public place that was not possible back then. It did affect everything from who sits where and who's visible and who can be Secretary of State to who's going to wash dishes tonight in everyday life. So I think these laws and the struggle that came out of the laws did affect everyday life. But obviously, we don't even have, for example, we do not have an affirmative right to vote in legislation. The Voting Rights Act, all it did was to allow the federal government to step in certain specified areas where there had been a history of discrimination and allow the Justice Department to send in federal registrars to supersede local officials in registering voters for all elections. That's an incredible power grab, which is why it was resented and why it generated all this language about big government and telling pointy-headed bureaucrats telling us what to do. But it was by and large a peaceful revolution, and it was aimed at areas where there was discrimination. It did not say all Americans have an affirmative right to vote, and it shall be guaranteed, and it shall be simple, and it shouldn't cost anything, and that sort of thing. It would be easy to fix that. We don't have an affirmative right to vote, and I think we need to work for one. So I'm not saying that even on matters of basic politics, let alone on matters of poverty, what Dr. King called the triple scourge of racism, poverty, and war, that these two pieces of legislation were sufficient by any means, but they did have a large empirical effect in the world, I think.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this and other UCTV programs, visit us online at www.uctv.tv.